Let me know if the audio sounds okay to everybody. All good? Okay, good. I have a lot of goods here, so perfect. Okay, well, tonight we're going to start with probably the most famous or widely cited chapter from The Road to Serfdom on why the worst rise to the top under a planned society. And there are a lot of parallels to today's world, today's society in here. We can talk about them. I'll point them out the best I can. And I'm going to start with an anecdote about when I was at the University of Tennessee some years ago, right during the collapse of communism, there was a Marxist on the economics faculty, and I ran into him in the parking lot. And this was after, you know, country after country in Central and Eastern Europe had been abandoning communism. And Marxism. And so I asked this young Marxist, well, what are you going to do now for a living? Bricklayer, carpenter, what? You know, Marxism is dead. And his response was, oh, no, this is good for us Marxists because we no longer are associated with all these terrible people like Stalin and the rest and all, you know, all the dictators. And of course, this is the flaw or the falsehood that Hayek talks about in his chapter, where he makes the point that brutality is inherent in any kind of planned society, any kind of socialism that you adopt, any kind of collectivism. It requires a large degree of coercion, brutality, bloodshed, so forth, if you really are going to follow through with your intentions of having one plan for the whole society. And so this young Marxist, like all Marxists, didn't know what he was talking about. And I think Hayek is right and he was wrong. And so that's the topic for the evening. And so, you know, the first point that's worth mentioning here is where Hayek says that in a socialist society, the dictator must choose between morality and failure. If his plans begin to fail, well then more and more coercion must be used. And this is not only under the type of dictatorships that Hayek was talking about, but think of the war on drugs today in the U.S. I've been observing the war on drugs. I guess it started in earnest in the early 1970s under President Nixon, where the government really started to put big money behind the so-called war on drugs. A lot of the same drugs that had been illegal since 1915, all of a sudden, the government was putting a lot of money behind enforcing the illegality of these various drugs. And so look at what has happened. As they fail time and time again for so many reasons, they keep doing such things as passing asset forfeiture laws where the government, just on a mere tip, that someone may be growing marijuana in their basement can go and grab onto their entire house and all of their property, which the government may hold onto for years until the person is proven innocent or not guilty of violating the drug laws. Look at the breaking down of doors by armed thugs working for the government looking for someone smoking a joint. We have hundreds of thousands of people in prison in America for the victimless crime of smoking pot somewhere. And so it's gotten worse and worse and worse. The brutality, the sort of the totalitarian mindset has just gotten worse and worse as the war on drugs has gone on. And, of course, this is not totalitarian social planning, but it's social planning. And nevertheless, and it's just one example that I would pick out of what Hayek is talking about here, where the leaders must choose between morality and failure. We saw a lot of this during the New Deal, too, during the Roosevelt's New Deal. And, of course, it never did work. It never did get America out of the Great Depression. But you had such things as thousands of price code police being employed by Roosevelt to make sure people were not dropping their prices, cutting their prices. There's a famous example of a New Jersey tailor thrown in prison for tailoring a pair of men's pants for 35 cents instead of the government prescribed 50 cents. And so this man was taken away from his family, their sole source of support during the Great Depression. Why? Because he was trying to compete in the marketplace by cutting price by 15 cents on tailoring a pair of men's pants. And so this sort of absurdity just mounts and mounts whenever you engage in planning of any kind on a kind of large level, as FDR did, as the war on drugs does, and so forth. And another very important point that Hayek makes here is that it is important that collectivism, in whatever form it is in, is judged by its results and not by its intentions. Any policy advocated by anybody would be judged good if you just judge it by its intentions, or at least its stated intentions. You never know if there's a hidden agenda. And I see this all the time in the academic world, where the older generation of academics today, of socialist academics, people who've been around for a while, the people who have spent their careers advocating socialism of one form or another, they still take the moral high road in academia everywhere, where it's philosophy, history, linguistics, you name it. They always take the high road on every college campus in America, save maybe one or two, even though the type of system that they have spent their careers advocating ended in the mass murder of hundreds of millions of people all around the world during the 20th century. And that's why I put a chapter of the book Death by Government by R.J. Rummel on the reading list. Rummel, he's a sociologist from the University of Hawaii, who has documented the mass murder of their own people by governments, not in war, but the mass murder of citizens who resist the imposition of socialism during the 20th century. And so these same people do this. They take the moral high road. That's why in a course that I teach at my university called Capitalism and Its Critics, I use the Road to Serfdom, and I have the students read the Road to Serfdom, and we spend several weeks on it. And then right after that, I have them write a paper based on another book called The Black Book of Communism. It's a short paper, and I ask them to just write about how one or two of the countries under socialism in the 20th century actually implemented socialism. What kind of coercion and force and violence did they employ? Because students just don't know these facts nowadays. And so, and of course, The Black Book of Communism is a good source for documenting just how it was that socialism required massive coercion, force, and murder in order to exist or to attempt to exist in the 20th century. And that's an important point. I think that we have to judge these things by the results, not by their intentions. And there's a classic quote on it's on page 151 of my version of The Road to Serfdom on this, where Hayek says in the second full paragraph, that socialism can be put into practice only by methods which most socialists disapprove is, of course, a lesson learned by many social reformers in the past. The old socialist parties were inhibited by their democratic ideals. They did not possess the ruthlessness required for the performance of their chosen task. But the new socialist parties of his day, of the 1940s, did possess the ruthlessness of their task. They realized that they needed it. They could never have socialism without being ruthless. And, of course, probably the most famous part of this chapter is Hayek's theory of why it is that the worst kind of people rise to the top under a collectivist system, a socialist system. And of course, the first reason is that the more educated a society is, the more diverse people's preferences are likely to be. But in order to have some sort of mass support for totalitarianism, you need a large group of people who have common preferences, or at least who can be talked into the idea that they have common preferences. And so the people who would tend to support dictatorship are the lower intellect crowd in any country. And that, of course, was readily available in Hayek's time in much of Europe. And that's who comprised the big supporters of the Nazi Party, among the other fascist parties in Hayek's time. So the less educated, the most docile and gullible is the second reason he gives. And we see this today. You know, if you want to look at an example of the left and the right, or the statists and the neoconservatives, I guess that's the domain of acceptable opinion today in America. I'm being sarcastic when I use the word acceptable like that. On the right, there's always some sort of bogeyman, another Hitler. There's always another Hitler, whether it's Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi or somebody. They're always trying to goad the docile and gullible into going along with another war based on duping them, on and frightening them into, we have to avoid another Hitler, we have to avoid another Holocaust, and so forth, as though either of these two dictators are anything at all like Adolf Hitler. It's really absurd. And on the left, I just wrote an article about that illustrates this phenomenon on the left, on lewrockwell.com a couple weeks ago. It's entitled Racial Racketeering for Fun and Profit. The subtitle is The Southern Poverty Law Center Scam. And this is a left-wing Democratic Party fundraising and propaganda organization that has connections to the Obama administration especially. And basically what it does is it raises tens of millions of dollars from the most docile and gullible liberals in America, using the American version of the word liberal, by trying to get them to think that there is a racist or a xenophobe or someone like this hiding behind every tree. Some of the examples I give were when the American Enterprise Institute held a public debate on immigration policy. This group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, broadcasted the defamation that AEI was mainstreaming hate. They claimed that the only reason why they were having a debate is they're motivated by hatred of immigrants from the third world. Another example, there's a group of military and police officers in America that formed a group called Oath Keepers. And all they do is affirm that they intend to keep the oath that they took to support the U.S. Constitution. The Southern Poverty Law Center labels them a hate group and uses the same language to describe them as they would use for the Ku Klux Klan or some terrorist organization out there. And there are many, many other examples. Basically, any group that opposes the centralized governmental power and its expansion is called a hate group. And it's really the juvenile, ignorant idea that there are no legitimate arguments on immigration policy or welfare policy and so forth, that the people who oppose these things are just hate the poor, or they hate minorities, or they hate people from Central America who want to come here as immigrants, and so forth. It's a very old gimmick that has been used, but that's an example of this, what Hayek is talking about when he says the docile and gullible can be herded into supporting a particular cause. You've got the Islamo-fascism on the right, where the subtle hint is that if we don't invade another Middle Eastern country, another Hitler will pop up. And then you've got the crazy left-wingers who want to really censor political debate. That's basically what they're into. The third reason that Hayek mentions for why the worst rise to the top in a collectivist society is that it's much easier for people to agree on a negative program than a positive one. And, of course, he writes about how in Europe of his time, capitalism, but the Nazis equated capitalism with the European Jews. And so they promoted hatred of the Jews, who were symbols of capitalism. And, of course, fascism was meant to be an alternative to capitalism. And so they used the Jews personified what the Nazis hated, which was free markets, classical liberalism, and so forth, the things that we've talked about in this class. So they needed human faces on the object of hatred, and the European Jews is what they used. And on page 154, Hayek says this, anti-Semitism and anti-capitalism sprang from the same root. It's pretty much the same thing. They worked hand in hand. And if you looked over for a couple weeks ago, I put the 25-point program of the Nazi Party on the reading list. At some point in there, they condemned the Jewish materialistic spirit. Those are the exact words they used. And so, of course, the materialistic spirit is capitalism, is what they're talking about, the marketplace. Okay. And another point worth commenting on here is when Hayek points out that socialism can only work in a very small group. In a large group, whatever large is, it could never work to begin with in by substituting the market, but it would also require massive violence and coercion. And of course, he's right about the small group. The family is essentially run like socialism in most cases. The old Marxian dictum from those with the ability to produce and to those with the needs, that's the family. You know, the children are unable to produce for themselves and earn money and support themselves. It's the parents who do that. Well, that's part of the socialistic dictum of Karl Marx, from each according to his ability, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. And so it does work with the family, but that's it. It can't work in a society. Another interesting point that I think is worth mentioning here is how individualists have always feared power, whereas collectivists worship power, political power in particular, of course. And, you know, the whole history of classical liberalism, which I put on the reading list in the first year, the couple of chapters from the von Mises book, Liberalism, talk about this. Classical liberals have always wanted to limit governmental power, to decentralize it. In the American case, Thomas Jefferson was of the belief that in the U.S. Constitution, the most important part of it, the cornerstone of it, was the Tenth Amendment, which says that there are certain delegated powers to the central government, but the Tenth Amendment says everything else is left to the people and the states. And James Madison, who was another American founding father, called that divided sovereignty. And so the classical liberals always wanted to limit power and to spread it around. They recognized that private property is a way to protect yourself from the abuse of those in power. If you can earn your own living in your own way, you are not beholden to politicians, and your life will not be controlled by them as much as if you are beholden to them. And that's exactly why individualists have always feared power, but the collectivists are the exact opposite. They worship power. Just look at the U.S. Congress, and especially the Democrats and most of the Republicans would fall into that category. Another important point that he makes here is having to do with the idea of the ends justify the means. An individualist is very skeptical of this because the ends could be brutality. But collectivists worship this too. They worship the idea that the ends justify the means. They often use it or they bring it up as a rationale for what they're doing. Okay. And of course, the ends always sound wonderful. They always sound something like the greatest good for the greatest number, the common good. And so, who could be against that? And so if we're pursuing that end, then any means are okay. And if you object to the means, you're objecting to this lofty goal that they announce. And that's basically the argument that Hayek is talking about here. And he reiterates a point that he made in earlier chapters, that all the talk about the good of the whole, the good of the group, is just propaganda and cover. And there's a quote here on page 164 about this. It's worth my repeating. He says this: once you admit that the individual is merely a means to serve the ends of the higher entity called society or the nation, most of those features of totalitarian regimes which horrify us follow of necessity. From the collectivist standpoint, intolerance and brutal suppression of dissent, the complete disregard of the life and happiness of the individual, are essential and unavoidable consequences of this basic premise. And the collectivist can admit this at the same time claim that his system is superior to the one in which the selfish interests of the individual are allowed to obstruct the full realization of the ends that the community pursues. Where there is one common, all-overriding end, there is no room for any general morals or rules. And that's another classic quote from The Road to Serfdom. And his explanation of how all the language about the common good is just propaganda. And in my book on Alexander Hamilton, which looks like this, I'm going to hold up the camera, Hamilton's Curse, I wrote a chapter on, part of a chapter on Hamilton, which I call, not me, but he's been called by political scientists the Rousseau of the right, because part of his philosophy, this is back in the early 19th century, he used many, many different words to describe this idea of the common good. He was, and here are some of them that I cataloged: the public good, the public interest, the public weal, the public safety, the public welfare, public felicity, the public happiness, the general good, the general interest, the common interest, the national happiness, the welfare of the community. These were all taken from speeches made by Alexander Hamilton, who was America's first big super statist, who thought government needed to grow far beyond the bounds of the Constitution. And so this is a very old trick. It preceded Hamilton in his time. Another important point here about from The Road to Serfdom is where Hayek talks about how he doesn't use this language, but that those who have a comparative advantage in ruthlessness will rise to the top under a socialistic system. He says that there are special opportunities for the ruthless and unscrupulous under such a system, because the way to succeed politically in a system is to brutalize your fellow citizens. And there's a quote at near the top of page 167 about this. He says, the positions in a totalitarian society in which it is necessary to practice cruelty and intimidation, deliberate deception and spying are numerous. It is through positions like these that the road to the highest positions in the totalitarian state leads. Okay. And so if you're good at that, if you're good at deception, lying, brutality, and so forth, that's the place for you. You'll do well. And he has a great quote here. He's paraphrasing the economist Frank Knight, who was a University of Chicago economist, was popular in the 50s and 60s. He says, the probability of the people in power being individuals who would dislike the possession and exercise of power is on a level with the probability that an extremely tender-hearted person would get the job of whipping master in a slave plantation. And that's some good rhetoric there. And it's a very good point too. And so the worst really will rise to the top in a socialist system. And keep in mind, Hayek is warning here. The whole book is a warning that countries like England or even America could move in this direction. He's not saying in the book that they would become like Nazi Germany or like fascist Italy, but that they could move in a direction that would be destructive of liberty and prosperity, and these are the reasons for it. He never did argue that we would become totalitarian necessarily, but we would lose a lot of liberty and destroy a lot of prosperity if we moved in the direction of planning, government planning. On the end of truth, the chapter on the end of truth, one of the first points Hayek makes is that myths must be created, and they certainly must. And, of course, the Soviet Union had all sorts of myths about it. It rewrote its history, to be sure. But, of course, am most familiar with the American history and the American myths. And one example I'd like to use to illustrate this is comes from a book review that I wrote on lewrockwell.com some time ago. It was the title of it is False Virtue, The Politics of Lying About History. And it's a short book review of a book by the famous novelist Robert Penn Warren. And Robert Penn Warren, he wrote All the King's Men, was one of his famous novels, for example. He's a very celebrated writer. In the early 60s, he wrote a book called The Legacy of the Civil War, the American Civil War. And what he writes about really illustrates this point that Hayek makes about myths that glorify the state. And so the standard story that the state has told about the Civil War is that this was a war of virtue, where the northern states invaded the southern states in order to end slavery and save the Union. And so here's what Robert Penn Warren says in his book, The Legacy of the Civil War. He says, "The northerner, with his treasury of virtue, feels redeemed by history. He has in his pocket not a papal indulgence peddled by some wandering pardoner of the Middle Ages, but an indulgence, a plenary indulgence for all sins, past, present, and future." So he's saying that the attitude of the northerner, which, by the way, the party, the Republican Party, was the party of the North from the American Civil War in the 1860s up through 1912, when Woodrow Wilson was elected president as a Democrat. So they had a monopoly, near monopoly, on political power. And so he's saying that what they did during the Civil War gave the Republican Party carte blanche to do anything it wanted, because by definition it was virtuous because it was the Republican Party that was doing it. That's the idea. He called this moral narcissism, and he said it's a poor basis for national policy, but it is the justification for our crusades of 1917 and 1941, the two world wars, and our diplomacy of righteousness with the slogan of unconditional surrender and universal spiritual rehabilitation for others. That's Robert Penn Warren saying this. And so now, where the myth-making comes into being, Robert Penn Warren hits the nail on the head here. He goes on to say that, well, this idea that the Republican Party and the North in the Civil War was so virtuous is a myth. In order to believe these things about this treasury of virtue, he says, you have to forget a lot of real history. And here's what Robert Penn Warren says. It is forgotten that the Republican platform of 1860 pledged protection to the institution of slavery where it existed, and it did, and that the Republicans were ready in 1861 to guarantee slavery in the South as bait for a return to the Union. It is forgotten that in July 1861, both houses of Congress, by an almost unanimous vote, affirmed that the war was waged not to interfere with the institutions of any state, slavery, but only to maintain the Union. It is forgotten that the Emancipation Proclamation was limited and provisional. Slavery was to be abolished only in the seceded states, and only if they did not return to the Union before the first of the next January, so that it really applied to nobody. He says, he goes on to say, it must also be forgotten that most northern states refused to adopt Negro suffrage, and that Lincoln was as much a white supremacist as any man of his time. It must be forgotten that Lincoln at Charlestown, Illinois in 1858 formally affirmed, and he's quoting Abraham Lincoln here, as saying this, I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. And so you have to forget all of the actual history of Lincoln and the Civil War in order to buy into this idea of American exceptionalism, of a treasury of virtue, that, you know, whatever the U.S. government does is virtuous. And so, I'm mentioning this because I think it is the biggest myth of all about the U.S. government, and I've written two books about it, as many of you know, starting with The Real Lincoln. And here's what Robert Penn Warren says this leads to. He says, the man of righteousness tends to be so sure of his own motives that he does not need to inspect the consequences. The effect of the conviction of virtue is to make us lie automatically and awkwardly, and then in trying to justify the lie, we lie to ourselves and transmute the lie into a kind of superior truth. And so this is Robert Penn Warren's take, and I think he's right on the money there. And this is a perfect example of what Hayek is talking about when he says the end of truth requires governments to create a long series of myths about government. Another series of myths that all must be created is the condemnation, the myths that condemn the civil society as inadequate and the free market as some sort of antisocial being, antisocial vehicle. And of course, in the field of economics, we have hundreds and hundreds of articles and books written about market failure, but far fewer about government failure. And so that's a big part of the attack on markets and the myth-making about markets. And of course, there's an ongoing debate about that by the Austrian school and others. And on the civil society, the government has replaced the civil society to a very large extent in countries like the U.S. Social Security replaces saving for your own retirement, public schools replace the responsibility that a lot of parents take to educate their own children, and so forth. And so the civil society must be demonized, as that must be the market, in order to hold on to power of the government. Okay. He also makes the point that language must be perverted, and it must. And he makes the obvious example of the word liberalism, which, as we discussed in the first week, meant liberty, comes from the word liberty. But now in America, if you're a statist and an opponent of individualism and liberty, you're called a liberal. And so that was just the theft of the word liberal by socialists in America. And the language is perverted in many other ways. In fact, Walter Block has several articles on Mises.org and LouRockwell.com over the years on language. I can't pinpoint the title of any of them, but if any of you are interested in investigating this, Walter Block has written several articles on urging people to use different language that has become popular. And Hayek makes the obvious point that the schools, the media, the popular culture must be controlled by the government, by the state, in order to sort of more or less brainwash everybody, which it does a good job of. And he also says there must be a contempt for liberty and intolerance. And intolerance is actually extolled. It's actually praised as virtuous out there. Okay, intolerance. And this is, I see this in the university world in America all the time, where there is this, in almost every university in America today, there is this stifling uniformity of opinion on social and political issues, where these small number of libertarian or conservative students who dare to speak up in opposition to this thing are usually demonized, shouted down, or intimidated by their professors. I hear stories about it all the time, and I see it all the time. And so we've done a good job in the U.S. of instilling a contempt for liberty and intolerance, if not in a contempt for liberty, ignorance of liberty. When I sponsored a lecture at my university 2 years ago by Walter Williams, the well-known George Mason University economist and nationally syndicated columnist, he gave a great talk on the role of government in a free society. And the big majority of the students, there were several hundred there, had never heard anything like this. They had no idea that there was an argument to be made for limited constitutional government. One of my students who attended Mises University, and he's on the video, if you were to apply to Mises University, he's on the video, saying that he took my course in American Economic History. And he was very surprised after taking several courses in macroeconomics. He was very surprised to learn that there were actually criticisms of the Fed that existed. That because he had taken several courses in money and banking and macroeconomics, it was all just praiseworthy of the Fed as some sort of super central planning agency. And he comes into my class, and holy cow, there are criticisms? Who criticizes the Fed? And of course, when I was in school and taking the same courses, I learned all about the great debates that did criticize the Fed. But this has evolved in the U.S. where there's very little criticism of the Fed apart from the Austrians in academia nowadays. The Fed has captured the academic economists in a very big way. And so this is what Hayek is talking about. And I have another little example, if I can dig it up here, regarding Jefferson and Hamilton, which I mentioned earlier. In Jefferson's first inaugural address, it's one of my favorite political speeches. And in it, I guess I lost it here because I quoted this before. In it, Jefferson basically expressed his philosophy of government, that government is best which governs least. He essentially says that the role of government is to protect life, liberty, and property, and it's not to take the food out of the mouth of those who have earned it, no taxation of that sort, and that's it. That's the role of government, to protect us and our life, liberty, and property. Alexander Hamilton condemned that speech in his words, as the symptom of a pygmy mind. And so this is exactly what Hayek is talking about here when he talks about the contempt for liberty on the part of statists. It's not just a criticism of the policies that they advocate, but it's utter contempt and dislike for them as people because they advocate freedom of human beings. Okay. And so, I've talked a little bit already in the course about the idea that fascism had its roots in socialism and Marxism, and so I'm not going to say much about that particular chapter, but I do want to add something here. I did put an article on the list by Rothbard on the anatomy of the state, and he has another article called The Nature of the State. Since I put that on the reading list, I don't read too much that I already asked you to read. But in Rothbard's book, The Ethics of Liberty, here, on page 168, he has a lengthy discussion of the role of intellectuals in propping up the state. And so this chapter, The End of Truth, does discuss, in The Road to Serfdom, does discuss the role of the schools, the media, the popular culture that must be controlled. And Rothbard does a much better job of it, a more detailed job of explaining how this works. And so I'll read a small passage of this to you. This is from The Ethics of Liberty, page 168. He says, "It is precisely the function of the state's ideological minions and allies to explain to the public that the emperor does indeed have a fine set of clothes. In brief, the ideologist must explain that while theft by one or more persons or groups is bad and criminal, that when the state engages in such acts, it is not theft, but it is legitimate and even sanctified act called taxation. The ideologist must explain that murder by one or more persons or groups is bad and must be punished, but then when the state kills, it is not murder, but an exalted act known as war, or repression of internal subversion. They must explain that while kidnapping or slavery is bad, it must be outlawed when done by private individuals or groups, that when the state commits such acts, it is not kidnapping or slavery, but conscription, an act necessary to the public will and even to the requirements of morality itself. The function of the statist ideologist is to weave the false set of the emperor's clothes to convince the public of a massive double standard, that when the state commits the gravest of high crimes, it really is not doing so, but doing something else that is necessary, proper, vital, and even in former ages by divine command. The age-old success of the ideologists of the state is perhaps the most gigantic hoax in the history of mankind." He's referring to the court historians who have invented false histories, such as the type that Robert Penn Warren was referring to in writing about the American Civil War, for example. And one more point about this that Rothbard makes, he says, "The reason that ideology is so vital to the state is that it always rests, in essence, on the support of the majority of the public, that is, the existence of the state. This support obtains whether the state is a democracy, a dictatorship, or an absolute monarchy. For the support rests in doing the willingness of the majority to go along with the system, to pay the taxes, to go without much complaint, to fight the state's wars, to obey the state's rules and decrees. This support need not be active enthusiasm to be effective. It can just as well be passive resignation. But support there must be. For if the bulk of the public were really convinced of the illegitimacy of the state, if it were convinced that the state is nothing more or less than a bandit gang writ large, then the state would soon collapse to take on no more status or breadth of existence than another mafia gang. Hence the necessity of the state's employment of ideologists, and hence the necessity of the state's age-old alliance with the court intellectuals who weave the apologia for state rule. And so even the most brutal of dictatorships, Rothbard believed, really does rely on the acquiescence of the majority, if not the approval, at least the acquiescence of the majority to keep them from revolting. And ideology and propaganda have always been important as far as that goes. Another thing that he writes about in this essay is the whole idea of consent of the governed and the manufacturing of consent. And this, after all, is really the theme here that Hayek is talking about, where the totalitarian dictator tries to amass a large group, a majority of the population, to get them to support what they're doing. And then, of course, in a democracy, if that is done, and planning is pursued in a democracy, the government and the state always says, "The people have spoken." This is governed by consent. They voted. We allow them to vote. We allow them free speech and so forth. And we're just doing their work for them. And so a lot of people will acquiesce in that. But one thing I would point out here is Rothbard does have a lengthy discussion of the American case and the American political philosopher and politician John C. Calhoun, who was one of Rothbard's favorites as far as political philosophers are concerned, who wrote a great book that I've mentioned before in this class called A Disquisition on Government. It was published in 1850, where he makes the argument that a written constitution would never be sufficient to limit government, because the people who get more benefits from government than they pay in taxes, and all the government employees and functionaries and contractors, would inevitably outnumber and outpower the taxpayers, no matter what the Constitution said. And they would eventually whittle down the words of the Constitution to render it essentially meaningless as a limitation on governmental power. And that, of course, is where we are today in America and in most other countries. And so Calhoun thought we would need something much more than just a written Constitution. And he promoted the idea of what it was called at the time, the concurrent majority. Any significant group of people, a state legislature, or even a collection of legislatures, should have the right, he said, to nullify federal law that they believe is unconstitutional, because the recipe for tyranny was to give the government itself sole monopoly power in deciding what is and is not constitutional. If you ever give the federal government itself the sole power through its judiciary, for example, to decide what our liberties are, then they will decide we have very few liberties. And that has turned out to be true. This was certainly prescient on the part of Calhoun, and much of his writings are based on classical liberal literature that came long before him. He was a very learned man, and that's why Rothbard mentions Calhoun here, and he also mentions secession. If you really believe that the government is based on consent, which it says in the Declaration of Independence, the American Declaration of Independence, that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, then if the people decide that they no longer consent, you should let them go in peace, if you really believe that, if you really believe that your government is based on consent of the governed, because consent is means consent. And so, yeah, no means no, as the saying goes. And, of course, that idea was destroyed by the American Civil War, where people in the southern states declared that they no longer consented to being ruled by Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. responded by killing more than a third of a million of them and burning many of the cities and towns to the ground with bombing. And so that idea ended in the 1860s in America. But Rothbard is writing about how this is a necessity in a society that wants to avoid dictatorship and totalitarian types of government. And it's very relevant to what Hayek is writing about in these chapters. And I think those are the points I wanted to touch on tonight. That's 45 minutes. That's about what I wanted to say tonight about these chapters and the road to serfdom. And I'll look through. I checked on the questions about an hour or so before the class, and there weren't any. So I'll just look through the chat here and see if there have been questions. If not, go ahead and write some down. Let's see what we've got. Let's see, Paul says that R.J. Rummel's statistics about fewer wars between democracies would be an argument for the U.S. to remove dictators. No, it wouldn't, because it's not right. Democracies, he's not right about that, that democracies never war on each other. The American Civil War was one democracy fighting another democracy, for example. And so it's just, he does a good job of documenting democide. But when he talks about how to put an end to democide, we must have democracy, that's just wrong. The French, after the French Revolution, they had democracy and they ended up with Napoleon. And so it's just untrue. Let's see. See if I can get another question here. See, Nikki is asking about the language article. I just mentioned that Walter Block has written a couple of articles on the use of language to support statism. If you just go on his archives on Mises.org, I think there are some, and or LouRockwell.com, I think you should find them. Here's a link right here, John Chancy. I found the link I'm looking at. Daniel says, Danny says, most students think of freedom as the same as democracy. Well, that's what the popular culture says, the media and so forth. That's a very bad thing to teach young people. Let's see. Paul Hagee says, whenever I use Jefferson in a discussion about freedom, I get the argument back about him owning slaves. Well, that's an ad hominem argument. You talk about his ideas. You're not saying that Jefferson was a perfect human being, but are his ideas right or wrong? Jefferson, when he advocated enforcing the Constitution, was it because he wanted to keep his slaves? I don't think so. That's an ad hominem argument that he owned slaves. Alexander Hamilton owned slaves. It doesn't mean that everything he said was incorrect. And so the statists who criticize Jefferson usually support Hamilton, but he was also a slave owner. And so when you get into ad hominem arguments like that, the purpose of that is to avoid discussion of the real issues. So stick to what Jefferson said if you're talking about his political philosophy, not the fact that he owned slaves. Let's see. document by Calhoun, and Nathaniel is asking, is his book A Disquisition on Government, which is online, that's also on sale by Liberty Fund? Do I see a concerted effort to counter misinformation? Yes, it's called the Mises Institute, and there are other efforts, of course, none as good as the Mises Institute, but on criticizing the Fed. Yeah, we do reach a lot of people, but of course, if you just rely on Washington, Washington is never going to change. We need to dump Washington if we're ever going to make any progress there. What's the difference between a neoconservative and a classical liberal? A classical liberal believes in freedom. A neoconservative does not. Neoconservatives, for example, I had an article on LewRockwell.com several years ago on, you could Google it, DiLorenzo on Irving Kristol, and you'll find it. It was on, he called himself the godfather of neoconservatism, and he explicitly condemned Hayek and the road to serfdom. This is saying this is not our philosophy. They believe in big government as long as they are in charge of running it. They want to reshape the world. They're essentially Wilsonians in foreign policy, and of course they are sort of the handmaidens for the military-industrial complex, which enriches many of them beyond their wildest dreams in return for the propaganda they support. That's why they've taken over places like Hillsdale College, and the first thing they do is put up statues of Abe Lincoln and Winston Churchill, and they're anything but classical liberals, that's for sure. There have been several books on the neoconservatives. LewRockwell.com has a whole archives on neoconservatism, so if you really want to read up on who these people are and what they're about, you could do that. Is there any other Austrian economists in Congress besides Ron Paul? No. His son is probably familiar with some of the free market economics, but as are some other members of Congress, but none of them that are very articulate. Oh, I don't know this thesis from the Wall Street Journal, so I'd have to read the Wall Street Journal article that's mentioned here before I can comment on it. Let's see. Paul King is asking, where do we think we are now? In terms of the pendulum between classical liberalism and statism. Yes, we are rushing a mad dash in the direction of collectivism. Because during the Bush administration, the Republican Party abandoned economics altogether, and it became the party of war and conquest. There was no discussion at all of economic policy, hardly ever, in the Bush administration. And, of course, war is the health of the state. That's how we got the Patriot Act and all these this explosion in government spending on the military side and the domestic side. And so Obama comes in, and he does nothing to slow down the growth of military spending, and he's a socialist through and through, has been his entire life. And so the bourgeoisie, as H.L. Mencken referred to as the general public, has acquiesced in full-blown collectivism today in the U.S., and I don't see any head back toward liberalism in the near future. Let's see. Yeah, Ron Paul certainly does reach a lot of people, millions, many millions all over the world, Nathaniel is mentioning. Paul Bages, I'm not sure, I'm probably mispronounced that. Why was Harry Jaffa so enamored with Lincoln? What accounts for such a difference of opinion? Well, Harry Jaffa is a Straussian, a student of the the atheistic numerologist philosopher Leo Strauss, and his analysis of Lincoln is based solely on Lincoln's speeches, not just Lincoln's speeches, but Harry Jaffa's creative interpretation of what he thinks is the real meaning of those speeches, which is often very different from the plain language of the speeches, and which is very often totally contradicted by historical facts and reality. And so in other words, this whole enterprise of Straussianism, as it's called, is really an enterprise of twisting the meaning of historical documents and speeches in order to promote an imperialistic military agenda. If you look at the website of Harry Jaffa's think tank, the Claremont Institute, they have a Churchill dinner every year, and they give a Statesman of the Year award. In recent years, it has gone to Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Victor Davis Hanson, all the big supporters of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they try to provide an intellectual and moral cover for these wars by saying things that essentially that Abe Lincoln would approve of, that Winston Churchill would have done this, and so forth. And so, in my view, it's very insidious, it's dishonest, and they have different views of Lincoln than Robert Penn Warren or me, because I base my opinion on the reality of what Lincoln actually did, not on Harry Jaffa's distortions of his a few selected political speeches. And that's really what it is. You will never hear Harry Jaffa quote Lincoln saying, "I, as much as any man, favor the superior position to belong to the white race." That's something Abe Lincoln said in a speech with Stephen Douglas, a debate with Stephen Douglas. You won't hear him say that. So he won't idolize that part of Lincoln. You won't hear him praise Lincoln for the fact that to his dying day, he, Lincoln, was planning on deporting all the freed slaves out of the country. They won't praise Lincoln for that, but that's a real fact, and is one of the reasons why I think he's not the secular god that he's been made out to be. See, Paul Hagee is a former neocon, so we should all congratulate him for going through cold turkey. And neoclassical is a discussion of neoclassical versus classical liberal. Neoclassical refers to economics in particular. It's an economic doctrine, right, Alfred Marshall in particular. Classical liberal is the philosophy of freedom that has evolved over the centuries. I mean, it involves free market economics and some neoclassical economics too, David Ricardo, Adam Smith, and so forth, but it's not just that. What kind of government do we have in the U.S. today? I invented a word for that. It's called fascialism, half fascism, half socialism. Fascism was ostensible private property, private enterprise, but very heavily controlled, regimented, and regulated by the states, and that describes most industry today. And then socialism, well, we had the government takeover of General Motors and much of the banking industry under the Obama administration. So we also, and of course, we have the government taking more than 40% of national income. So we have a big socialistic sector and a big fascialistic sector with a few pockets of capitalism floating around here and there. Robert Higgs calls it participatory fascism. Fascism of the 1930s was dictatorship. We have democracy and fascism today, essentially, in America. Let's see. David Gordon has criticized the Straussians. He has a big, long essay on Harry Jaffa and the Straussians on lewrockwell.com also. Let's see, Paul King says, when communism failed, he's heard that a lot of communists co-opted the environmentalist movement. Well, the environmentalist movement was dominated by advocates of socialism long before the fall of communism. In the 1960s, there were a lot of self-described communists. One of the gurus of environmentalism is Barry Commoner, a biologist named Barry Commoner, and he has written numerous books claiming that the way to get rid of environmental problems is to adopt socialism. And so, and he was writing that long before the collapse of communism. But I think it is true that a lot of people who were advocating communism by saying it will help the people, it's good, it's for the people. That's why a lot of these communist countries were officially called the People's Republic of, you know, of wherever. And of course, whenever a government is called the People's Republic, you can always be guaranteed that the people had nothing whatsoever to do with what that government was doing during the 20th century. But yeah, a lot of these people changed their tune, and they started saying, the hell with the people. We don't care about the people anymore. We care about the bugs and the worms and the insects and the trees and the rocks and all that. That's what's important. And so so they changed their tune altogether. But it's all about control, power, planning, and ordering other people around. That's what collectivism is all about. And they're just they're always looking for a new excuse. It was in the 20th century. It was, well, you know, we will bury you economically, as Khrushchev said. And of course, that didn't work out for them. And so now, you know, we will save you from global warming, is their mantra. They're known in some circles as watermelons. That is, they're red on the inside, but green on the outside. Let's see, Trevor thinks we need to make Austrian economics cool. Well, go at it. Good luck. Give it a try. Yeah, I think, you know, we should take the Hayekian lesson that information, the most important information is decentralized information, and that we can all do our part in this. We can all do something different to try to make these ideas more appealing. And I have no centralized plan for how we should make these ideas appealing to the masses, but they are appealing to the masses in a great way. And, you know, many of you have seen, for example, the Keynes Hayek rap video, which I think is fabulous that this was done. And Joe Salerno and a few other people from the Mises Institute collaborated in the creation of that with the producer of that. And that's one way of making these ideas more popular. Mises Academy is another way. And let's see. Let's see. When you talk to people about the state being separate from the people with its own agenda, Common reply is that it can't be the case because political office is ephemeral. So do politicians protect the state at large even when they're in opposition? Well, if you look at Washington, D.C. politics, there are some things that just are not discussed. The Fed. We're not going to talk about the Fed. That's why Ron Paul is such a pariah. You know, the Fed finances, and has for many, many decades, a large part of the state's adventures. And so we're not going to talk about the Fed other than to praise it. And so, yeah, and so you could be a minor critic of the Fed even, and there have been some over the years, but you don't question the fundamental existence of the Fed. You can be a critic of antitrust policy, but you don't advocate abolishing antitrust. That's a part of the federal power structure that creates all the jobs and the patronage that's created that keeps these people in power. And so that's why these people hate the Mises Institute and they hate Ron Paul, because you know, we look at these institutions and we say if they're bad institutions, if they destroy prosperity, they destroy freedom, and they only enrich a small group of political connivers, liars, and misfits, we should do away with them. They're unreformable, and so they don't want that discussion being made in public, but there are a lot of us who are doing our best to make sure that it is made in public. That's what's the great thing about the internet. We don't have to have any gatekeepers to tell us that what we're saying is illegitimate. We can have our own websites and our own classes like this one, and go ahead and say these things. 30 years ago, 20 years ago, you couldn't do this. comic books, you know, there is a comic book version of The Road to Serfdom. Just Google it and you'll find it. I'm sure somebody will find it. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Danny was working on this in a human action comic book series. I think he talked to me about this at some conference in California, I think it was, a couple years ago. I was asked recently if I would be interested in writing an updated version of The Law by Friedrich Bastiat in contemporary language, making all the same arguments, or most of the same arguments, but in today's language with today's examples and so forth. I haven't decided to do that yet, but that's something, one idea that can be done. Let's see. Paul wants to know if politicians are ignorant or devious. Well, you can't talk about all as long as Ron Paul is in office. He's not ignorant, of course, and I wouldn't call him devious. But as a rule, in general, politicians seem to be studiously ignorant of economics, especially someone like Obama. I call him belligerently ignorant of economics with some of the things that he says and doesn't say on the subject. And you know, a good understanding of economics helps you understand that you cannot be a central planner. You can't go to Congress and join a group of 535 people who will run the country, as they say. It doesn't work. And so if you understand economics, it might ruin your taste for becoming a politician because you understand it's futile. It's all a pretense. That's why Hayek called his Nobel Prize speech was entitled The Pretense of Knowledge. And that certainly is pervasive. And in fact, just today I read that Obama made a speech and assured the public that the political prose in Washington will solve all these problems of the debt that exists out there. And, you know, what hubris and the pretense in a statement like that. And that's exactly the kind of thing Hayek is talking about with the pretense of knowledge. Let's see what else we have here. Hey, we could use more comic books. Yeah, I think you can do a lot of good as a local politician. People, you know, you can have more influence if you can talk to people face to face and persuade them to go along with what you want to do at the local level. It's very different, especially in a small town, than at the federal level, to be sure. So, you know, nothing wrong with that. If you want to run for office, as is being said here, good luck. Let's see. We have a comment that says from Nathaniel, you cannot believe in collectivism and be a Christian. Well, most Christians seem to be collectivists or liberals. Most Jews, too, in America. And it's a conundrum, isn't it? You know, you're advocating the use of force, threats, intimidation, and even prison or worse against people who simply have a difference of opinion on government than you do. And that doesn't sound like Christian charity to me. But I do know a lot of people who really don't realize this. They don't really realize to think about how much force and coercion is involved in government. They've mostly been educated by public schools, I guess. Well, I don't know if I can comment on the current debt ceiling debate other than it's all a big farce. What needs to be debated is whether or not we need to keep all these government agencies, period. We've got the government sucking 60% or more of the resources of the country into a black hole, and they're arguing over whether we should increase it to 60.5 60.05% or 60.06%. That's what the debt debate is about. And so they're ignoring the real issues of just abolishing tooth and nail dozens and dozens of government programs that no one wants, no one ever wanted, and were just imposed on us. That's what governments do. And so I think it's a farce. It's all grandstanding. Let's see, Neil O'Connor, over Lincoln's economic background, almost none. You could read about it in my book, The Real Lincoln. He only had less than 1 year of formal education, period. He educated himself in the law as an adult. But the only economic background he had is he knew about some of the phony arguments for mercantilism, for protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare, that had been around for several decades via Great Britain and the PR people for the British mercantilists. And so Abe Lincoln made many of the same ignorant arguments that the British mercantilists made long before him. For example, he once said that the transportation costs were a complete waste, that any item that has as part of its price transportation costs from Canada, for example, should be prohibited in the country. We shouldn't allow it coming into the country. And of course, that would, if you believe that, you would think that someone from Illinois should be prohibited from selling something to someone in Indiana, because you would have to transport the good from Illinois to Indiana. And so, and this was an argument made decades before Lincoln. He claimed that if we got rid of the central bank, it would destroy the lives of thousands. You can read about these things, like I said, in my book, The Real Lincoln. And so Lincoln was basically an economic ignoramus who was a political water carrier for the mercantilist special interests of his day, the protectionists in the steel industry, especially in Pennsylvania and New York and elsewhere. He was a big advocate of corporate welfare for the railroad corporations especially, and he was a railroad lawyer before he became president, let's not forget. And he was a lifelong advocate of a central bank, and he complained bitterly for decades over the demise of the first central bank, the Bank of the United States, and he signed the legislation for the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts, which nationalized the money supply during his administration. And so that's, in a short nutshell, that's what Lincoln's ideas were about. Bad ideas on economics. Let's see what else we have here. See, how to explain that socialism sounds compassionate. Well, socialism, under the name of socialism, governments murdered hundreds of millions of people during the 20th century. Under capitalism, we had prosperity and peace during the 20th century, by contrast. Which do you choose to live under? That's what I would say. Let's see, downsizing government. What is Cato Institute's worldview? Well, you have to go on their website and find out. I'm not a spokesman for the Cato Institute. When did Lincoln be held as the greatest president? Well, that's interesting. You know, there's a book written about 2 years ago entitled, the subtitle is America's Most Reviled President. The Hated Mr. Lincoln, I think, was the main title. America's Most Reviled President. And the author is named Taggart. And he's a historian. And what he did was he looked at all the newspaper accounts and magazine accounts of during Lincoln's own time. And during his own lifetime, he was by far the most hated and despised president in all American history. He waged war in his own country. He adopted conscription. He shut down 300 opposition newspapers. He imprisoned tens of thousands of Northern civilians for simply voicing opposition to him and his administration. He ordered the shooting of deserters from the army en masse, and so he was very hated. And this all after the war and after he was assassinated, the Republican Party, with the help of the New England clergy, created the myth of Father Abraham. But this book on by Larry Taggart, which I have reviewed on lewrockwell.com, gives chapter and verse of how Lincoln, during his own lifetime, was probably the most at the bottom of the list of presidents in terms of how they are revered. But he has been turned into the face of the American state in combination with the myth that I referred to earlier that Robert Penn Warren wrote about in his book, The Legacy of the Civil War, that the sainted Lincoln has been transformed into the sainted U.S. government. So the deification of Lincoln that took place after his death led to the deification of the presidency in general, not just Abe Lincoln, but the presidency, and to the U.S. government in general. That's the game. Yeah, Mike Church is a friend of mine, so Paul Hagee mentions him, sure. So asking about the Heritage Foundation, well, I'd say read their publications. I haven't kept up with the Heritage Foundation. So The Unpopular Mr. Lincoln is the name of the book by Larry Taggart. The Heritage Foundation is a nest of neocons, neoconservatives on foreign policy, although they do have some good people on economics and on the welfare state and other issues. But the conundrum for all these think tanks is that a war is the health of the state. So on the one hand, if they're making limited government arguments, and on the other hand, endorsing the wars in the Middle East and elsewhere, they're inherently contradicting themselves in what they're doing. Okay, any more questions? Let's see, Danny wants to know, I'm working on a book, Feet of Clay, about Henry Clay. It's coming, I promise. Let's see. They don't have a world, well, they'll tell you they have a world view at the Heritage Foundation. Ed Fulner, who's been the president of it forever, since its founding, he's the founder too, co-founder, he'll tell you it has a world view, but I think it's inconsistent. Okay. Well, we seem to be running out of steam here. If there are no more questions, we'll call it a night, I guess. Fascism a life? I'm not sure what that says. Is fascism a life cycle? Does fascism have a life cycle before it collapses? It's a form of socialism, and socialism doesn't work as an economic system. It collapses. Look at the U.S. economy now. It's 10% unemployment and losing hundreds of thousands of jobs every month still. It is collapsing. I'm not sure about the commons. Are there any resources that I believe are part of the commons? There are some that aren't privately owned, but I'm not sure what the question is. Republican Liberty Caucus. I'm not too familiar with them. Well, on the issue of private ownership, people always take better care of their own property than when it's a commons. And so the only place where common ownership really works is in relatively small groups where social ostracism can be applied and social pressure can be applied to behave yourself and not ruin the commons. And so you have that sort of thing. But as the groups get larger, you have the tragedy of the commons. You have people destroying the forest and the rivers and so forth because there's no ownership. Fraser insists that every cubic meter of air should be owned. Well, I'm not going to debate that. I don't know what they're talking about. It doesn't really have anything to do with Hayek either. See, well, it looks like we're running out of gas just about. Thanks a lot for attending again. I hope you learned something tonight. And we have one more coming up, and we'll have more fun next time. Thanks to Danny again for doing a great job.